did you come out of this thinking more or less of Congress and of these people?
Well, I came out thinking more of these people but less of the institution, and but in large part because the of the activities and the inactivities that took place while I was covering it. I mean, when I decided to do this book, it was on the night of the midterm elections, and as a direct result of seeing these, 87 Republicans who would be freshmen, many of whom had no political experience, previous to this, I thought, the House is not only going to be, relevant because it'll be the point of the spear for the Republicans, but it'll also be, raucous and given that a lot of these guys believed they had an unambiguous mandate to change the way business was done, that it might really be game changing. I knew going in, but I guess I didn't realize the degree to which paralysis would result. Above all, what was clear to me was that the Republican leadership had no control over their own members and thus couldn't be a faithful partner in negotiations with the Obama White House. So, I found, though, by talking to a lot of these freshmen that they, they have an earnest belief system, that they speak what's on their mind, and I really came to respect them as individuals, but the overall output is a pretty lamentable one.
Well, does the belief system that they came in with prevent them from being good congressmen? I mean, they may be good people, but I'm just wondering if are they too dug in, or what was your sense of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, their point of view, Ross, is that they were sent by the people to slam on the brakes, to roll back the Obama administration's most monumental, pieces of legislation like health care, to slash government spending, and to severely streamline regulations. And so, but the problem was that they had no appreciation for the realities of divided government, as their leader, Speaker John Boehner, did. And so Boehner, to appease them, would allow the legislation originally crafted by the Republicans to get pulled further and further to the right, such that it stood no chance whatsoever of being passed by a democratically controlled Senate and signed by a Democratic president. So from their perspective, they were doing what they were sent to do. But because, we live in, divided times, the reality was that nothing got done.
Well, you have him in this interesting situation, standing in this town hall, trying to decide whether, as you put it in the book, whether he's a representative or a leader. And I'm curious, both in his specific case and when you kind of look at this class of people, what did they learn? What did they come away thinking, well, I'm going to have to adapt to that? Or did they come away saying, well, I'm exactly right, and we're just going to wait for the world to adapt to me?
Yeah, Farenthold's point of view was that the Republicans compromised too much. Now, that would be quite surprising, I think, to readers who watched the debt ceiling stalemate take place and felt that the Obama administration, more than any other side, caved in those negotiations. But Farenthold's point of view, and the point of view expressed by a lot of these freshmen, was that they've never had any intentions to raise the debt ceiling to begin with, and that they did do so, incurred a lot of wrath among their constituents. They really heard from them. And so, Farenthold told me, and it's memorialized in the book, that after the debt ceiling, he was of a mind to be far less compromising. He was of a mind not to give government programs the benefit of the doubt, but the other way around, to slash first and ask questions later. So I think that even as public opinion toward Congress plummeted and the approval rating went down to 9%, these guys didn't behave like people who thought maybe we'd better get our act together, but instead were even that much more calcified in their mindset.
I guess I'm curious which group you think doesn't have their act together. I mean, you've got Boehner and sort of the management looking at this thing and you know, maybe not reading them right. And then you've got this group of freshmen who are, you know, got to learn the ways of the system, but also are, you know, seem fairly well attached to the voters who sent them there. Who's not reading the situation correctly?
Well, I mean, they're both reading aspects of the situation correctly. The thing is that these freshmen aren't that much different in terms of their belief that they are, you know, here on a mission than other freshmen who came en masse as a result of, you know, some wave. I mean, I chronicle in the book several of them going back to the 1870s when, in reaction to the corrupt Ulysses Grant administration, a whole lot of freshmen from the opposition party came in 1932. With FDR, I think 131 Democratic freshmen came in, and every time this takes place, they believe that the public has spoken, and that everyone else in the House is just going to have to kind of submit to the wishes of the public. As represented by these new exponents. But I think that, you know, that's the tricky thing about the House, that that these are sometimes emotions or, you know, are spasms of sentiment by the public, but they don't necessarily mean reverse course 180 degrees. I don't find any fault with Speaker Boehner for recognizing the realities of divided government. Boehner himself, you know, is probably temperamentally suited to this situation more than others would be. As the book mentions, he has an expression, which is that if you say follow me and start walking and then look over your shoulder and no one's behind you, you're not leading, you're just taking a walk. And so, you know, so Boehner, you know, to use the phrase attributed to the Obama administration, has to some degree led from behind. It's not, you know, politically, it's not a very appealing approach, but he's been left with little choice.
What would you change?
Well, there are a couple of things that could be done to change the institution, and I think to, you know, introduce more comity. One of them would be redistricting reform, because the slow, or I shouldn't say slow, it's actually been escalating the diminishing of swing districts,
right,
as a result of state legislatures getting to draw maps to suit their own partisan ends, has meant that the people who come to Washington come from really red districts or really blue districts. So they're really, you know, progressive or they're really conservative, and they're not of a mind to see eye to eye on anything, and in fact are punished back home in their district if they do, since the name of the game in districts like that is not the general election, but the primary. And if you're a Republican, for example, and you know don't vote for the Ryan budget, you're going to get primaried by somebody from the Tea Party.
Right.
And you know, so I think that, you know, redistricting reform, which is, would not be an easy thing to pass for a host of obvious reasons, would help a lot. The other thing it would help would be the emergence of a third party. And I think that if there were a third party that began to sap moderate and independent votes from both sides, then both Republicans and Democrats might feel, you know, some existential pain, and
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
be more willing to compete for those votes in the center by getting things done. You know, but these are kind of long shots, and I think that the obvious remedy is for voters to show their unambiguous disgust by voting as many incumbents out as possible. What remains to be seen, I mean, it is in this immediate case whether 2012 is going to amount to a repudiation of the Tea Party mindset that helped guarantee paralysis in government. My suspicion is that it won't. A lot of these guys, like Farenthold, for example, were awarded a new district in redistricting, and so Blake Farenthold went from a district where he was imperiled to one where he will serve comfortably for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But even in cases where the districts remain competitive, You know, it's probably going to be more about the electoral dynamics from the top of the ticket, from the presidential race, than from any kind of specific animus generated by what took place, you know, over the last year.
Do the people inside know it's broken, and do they have some kind of, I mean, other than, you know, sort of, you know, beating their chest a little bit, I mean, do they have any sort of ideas about what they ought to be doing?
Well, yes. I mean, and I should hasten to add, Ross, that I met a lot of congressmen, including, you know, some of the Tea Party freshmen who actually, you know, were interested in getting things done and did work with people on the other side of the aisle. But the reality is that these things take place in spite of leadership, not because of them. Leadership doesn't, on either side, the Pelosi Democrats and the Boehner Republicans, don't say to their caucus, hey, you know, let's really try to do something that that's going to help people, and that means working on the other side of the aisle. Instead, they're about victory. They're about passing a partisan agenda such that they can make a statement and maintain power if they've got it, and take control if they don't. And that's the dynamic that I saw.